Hey Rob, thanks for coming on.
Hi Jake, yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So, what made you want to make this film?
What made me want to make this film? There were a number of reasons, but I guess fundamentally, I had my own experience of a very expanded state of consciousness, and it was very deep and very profound, and I was left afterwards with a lot of questions. What was that? What did that mean? How do I begin to integrate that new perspective of myself and life into my life, my daily life? And also, alongside that, I think, what would I like to have known myself going into an expanded state of consciousness for the first time? With hindsight, what would have been useful for me to know before? So I think, in many ways, the making of this film was an important part of my own journey of exploring this topic, of integrating my own experiences, and also wishing to offer other people, perhaps you could say, maybe a tool to either prepare them for stepping out into these new territories, new inner continents. Or likewise, perhaps to help them integrate an experience they've already had, however they happen to have come by that experience, you know.
So that's a very pure way of going about it. So it's just, you have this experience and then you're kind of just interested in exploring this territory and then making some kind of, piece of art out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a trained filmmaker. When I began this project, I'd already been making films in one way or another for about 10, 11 years. So I came to this with a really what I feel is quite a strong tool bag, in terms of experience and capacity to make a film. And I think most importantly for me, when I'm making films, to tell a story. So much of my training as a filmmaker and as a documentary maker was about telling stories. And for better or worse, and so often worse, what you can come across in the world of documentaries is very passionate, very impassioned amateurs making a documentary about an issue, a subject, a topic they care deeply about. They want to change the world, they want to tell everybody. This has to stop or this has to start. And they're not always trained filmmakers or trained storytellers. So what you can often get is pieces that are quite kind of perhaps quite propagandist maybe, or likewise just lacking in kind of lacking in the kind of more neglecting the more aesthetic, creative side, the audience experience side, the importance that if you want people to give you their full attention for 90 minutes, 2 hours, you've got to give them something in return other than a lecture about, what you think should happen or shouldn't happen. And that's where the story comes in. That's how humans have always communicated our most important things to each other. And that's what I try to do with journeys.
Yeah, I think that issue with documentaries, that seems especially true with some of the psychedelic stuff. It's just people are very passionate about the subject. It's got a lot of taboo. A lot of people think that's for poor reasons. So then, there's a lot that's kind of pumped out on the internet, but a lot of it doesn't seem very well refined or well polished. Like I've seen some stuff on YouTube here and there, but yours was definitely like you could tell that there was more experience going into it, and like you knew how to craft the film a lot better. Is that something that you had been interested in for a while in psychedelics and in the is that something that you had noticed, like kind of the lack of more professional quality documentaries or films about them?
I don't, it wasn't a kind of, that wasn't my starting point. I didn't survey the psychedelic documentary literature and say, okay, there's something lacking. Someone needs to make something. Because I just don't think that would have sustained me for the 5 years it took to get that film made from initial concept to kind of to putting it out in the world. As you sort of noted earlier, it's for me it was in many ways, while I was working on it, I had the feeling that the film was kind of coming through me, mm-hmm. that this film needed to be here in the world, and that I was somehow the middleman, birthing something important. So yeah, that was my starting point. Once I began, it looks like I'm making this film. I did have a look and see what was on offer. And I did find myself taking note, perhaps, of what I saw people doing well, and perhaps I saw people doing that didn't work for me so well as an audience member, mm-hmm. and taking that on board when I made the film. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned 5 years. You know, I think a lot of people, and myself included, I'm very ignorant about what it takes to produce a film. And I think a lot of people probably don't know how much goes into it and what the nuts and bolts are. Could you talk a little bit about that? You know, this 5-year process, what all does that include in making something like this? I mean, I know it's a loaded question. It's a big one, but.
Sure. I mean, how long have you got? I try and tell it in less than 5 years.
Yeah, but,
no, it's interesting because, and you look at we're on a podcast right now, and that is such a different animal. You know, we'll talk for however long we talk, and then perhaps there's a little bit of editing and tweaking, and then that goes out, right. And people sit and listen to it. And it, Journeys is, I think it's 84 minutes long, something like that. So, you know, the discrepancy between how long it takes to record a podcast episode and how of the same length, and how long it takes to make a film is huge. And I sometimes reflect on that myself when I'm listening to podcasts. I think, God, why did I choose the 5-year way to communicate things? But I think, you know, there are reasons, and one of the things I think making a film like Journeys allowed me to do is, you know, it's a very I think it's a very dense film. It's a very densely packed film that perhaps invites a second or a third watch for people to really digest all the information that's in there. And so it's loaded with meaning. Every moment, every frame, every second, I would say, is loaded with meaning, whether that's music, sound effects, visual animations, the wisdom, the very, very valuable insights the interviewees are offering. You've got three different voice actors voicing the characters of Timothy Leary, Aldous Huxley, and Alan Watts. Mm. And so you're working with each voice actor on exactly how to form, you know, each paragraph. How's that going to be delivered? What's the tone? What's the speed? What's the pacing? It's a very, very fun and creative process, and it's also a very time-consuming one. So Henry Lamborn, who did the animations for the film, his work's in I would say virtually every frame of that film has featured some of Henry's work. You know, so that's a single-handed effort that just amazes me to this day, really, on his part. And he achieved such brilliantly kind of efficient and creative ways of helping support these stories by these three famous authors. So just very quickly, you know, the film starts, you have an idea. My process, well, maybe that takes me, if it's okay, that takes me into my process of choosing the material for the film. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So there was a whole process of, my starting point was, I'm making this film about expanded states of consciousness and what they can teach us and how they might or might not be able to help our troubled world figure out some of its issues, or at least us, maybe, to figure out some of our issues as humanity. And my starting point was kind of, you know, the culture I was living in, so Western culture. That was my first starting point. I'm very aware that many, if not all, human cultures throughout the world have had their own means historically of exploring the human psyche, the deep psyche, through various different medicines, shamanic practices, substances and no substances. But my starting point as a sort of a young Western man was to say, okay, what's my culture got to say about these? And you know, the Western literature doesn't, you know, only goes back, you know, with exceptions maybe. People can talk about ancient Greece and so on in the West, but modern examples go back, you know, about 100 years, and really start getting going fully about 60-70 years ago, with Aldous Huxley, etc., in the 50s. So my starting point was, yeah, what does the Western literature have to say about psychedelics? And then I read ferociously everything I could get my hands on about psychedelics, and somehow these stories started arriving for me, started constellating. And I had the very difficult job of boiling down everything Western culture had to say, you know, into 3 15-minute stories.
Yeah.
And then boiling down what everything Timothy Leary, Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley had to say into 15 minutes each. So there's a lot of reducing in filmmaking. It's not usually, the struggle isn't what to include, it's usually what not to include.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so you're trying to, you know, learn as much as you can about those guys and then figure out, you know, like what's their main essential message. Because in my experience with a lot of those guys, and this seems to be the case with Watts, like usually you can boil it down to, and not, you know, it's not perfect. Like there's other things that get lost when you squeeze too much. But like a lot of these guys, you can boil down to like one or two things that really drove them. And it was like a really core insider message to them. So you're trying to figure out, like what passage, what story, or what collection, like you can kind of put together to translate that in their words as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, I had a much longer short list of possible psychedelic, you know, I don't like this phrase, but you know, what you could say, trip reports. You know, people's descriptions of their experiences of deeply altered states of consciousness, and you know, I chose these three for a number of reasons. But you know, in that mix was just how influential they've been, how influential they were, and continue to be, on the kind of the wider dialogue around these substances.
Did you have any of this kind of context before you had your first experience, or was it something that you just kind of did out of curiosity and then after the fact, then you went exploring like the literature and those kinds of ideas?
I think it was mostly afterwards. I think a little bit before, but it was really having had the first-hand experience myself that really invited me to really start taking these experiences more seriously and really trying to understand what they mean and what they can offer us. Yeah.
How did you go about the working with the voice actors and trying to get that delivery right? Because the delivery was great. I've mostly through audio, I've mostly listened to, you know, Alan Watts lectures. I haven't listened to as much of Leary and Huxley. Read some of their stuff. I haven't listened to them as much verbally, but I thought from what I was familiar with, the delivery was so good and entertaining throughout the film. How did you kind of fine tune that with them?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, working with actors is can be a really fun process for a director, and for a documentary director it's probably rarer. So I really enjoyed, I had quite some background of doing that, and yeah, each actor has a different process, you know, has a different approach. I think for me, the most important thing was to agree on a specific, on a tone, to find the through line of, let's say, Leary's story, to find the through line of Huxley's story, and to figure out the delivery of that. And one interesting thing for me was some of the actors perhaps had a lot of experience recording audiobooks, where their voice has to sell everything. Their voice has to sell the whole story. So, for instance, with one actor, it was part of the process was saying, "Hey, you might not see them now, but there's going to be a lot of visuals telling this story too. Do less. Actually, your voice needs to do less. You know, let the quality and your skills come through by doing less." But yeah, so it was like finding an intention or a through line. And also, so in the case of Leary, you know, with William Roberts, the guy, very, very good voice actor who did the voice of Timothy Leary, in the end, what we agreed on, what my direction to him was, I said, imagine we're two scientists sitting by the fire late one night, and you're telling me this kind of slightly chilling tale of what happened to you. So there's a grimness, there's a seriousness, there's a kind of, I somehow had Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in mind. You know, it's like Dr. Frankenstein telling the story of the monster he created. So it wasn't, you know, you don't play it for laughs, you don't play it for comedy. I often find less is more.
Yeah.
And just lastly, it's I think it's really important to give actors, voice actors and otherwise, freedom to make it their own and not try and backseat drive them, not on the pronunciation of every word or every line.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that's an actor's worst nightmare, is when you start sort of being too dictatorial as a director. So I tried not to do that.
Yeah, another thing that was interesting to me was the style. And the tone was very different than what you'll often hear with psychedelic films and messaging and stuff like that from the people that are supportive of them. It's usually much more bright and colorful, flowery, a little bit more sensationalizing in ways. But yours was, like darker. The animation was darker. The colors were different. It was a pretty stark contrast from what you'll usually see. Why'd you choose that style?
Yeah, it's nice to hear that landed for you, that you noted that. I mean, me and Henry, the animator, agreed at the start to absolutely avoid any tie-dye cliches. You know, I was insistent I wouldn't put any kind of archive footage of people dancing at Woodstock in the film. You know, it's like...
Yeah. Yeah, it's a totally different style than that.
I think every psychedelic documentary I watched had the same clip of this kind of woman dancing around a Woodstock with flowers in her hair or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, good on her. But I wanted to do something very different in that regard, to avoid all the cliches and all the woo-wah, and hopefully not to glamorize these substances too much either, you know, to bring a kind of cautious, oh, these are very interesting and can they potentially be very beneficial? Let's talk about that. And, you know, and so that went into the visual style, the animations, and, you know, also, I guess, my choice of stories as well, and the trajectory of the whole film, let's say, for instance, in the order I chose to include those three stories, there's a journey for the audience there, and the first chapter is a pretty dark chapter. Timothy Leary's first overwhelming first LSD trip, where he has what he called a shattering ontological confrontation with the universe. I mean, you know, that's big stuff, and it certainly wasn't flowers and light for him at all. In many ways, what he was saying is it kind of broke him open. And as I think then one of the interviewees, Rick Doblin, says, you know, it's like, yeah, on the one hand, it could be Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall and being in a puddle and nobody can put the pieces back together again. Or is it the little bird hatching out of the egg, in which case there's some breaking needing to happen. And I don't come down on either one side of those, but I wanted to include both perspectives. And I think, you know, Leary was given this LSD by Michael Hollingshead, an Englishman, who actually contacted Aldous Huxley first, and Aldous Huxley said to him, you need to go see Professor Timothy Leary at Harvard University. So there's all sorts of nice, interesting connections between the different characters of this film, behind the scenes. But, Michael Hollingshead was a very shifty, shadowy figure who was responsible for introducing a lot of those very quite well-known people to LSD for the first time in the early 1960s. And from what I understand, he went on to kind of misuse or abuse the power that being the man with the LSD gave him. And I've heard some pretty shocking stories of how he behaved after that meeting with Timothy Leary. So I think, you know, it's important to include the light and the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying, I think, to give the audience as balanced a perspective as I could on things.
I think you really did a good job of not leaning too far on one side or the other. I was pretty surprised by the way that it opened with that first story of Timothy Leary, because I knew that the documentary was encouraging, you know, exploring consciousness in these various kinds of ways. So to open it like that, I was like, well, that's interesting. That's usually not what you'll hear. And I actually think that's probably much more attractive to people that are, you know, coming in either somewhat indifferent or on the fence, because, you know, it might turn somebody off immediately just to hear about it, like the Woodstock, you know, the dancing with the flowers and all that stuff. It's like, okay, yeah, we've heard that story before, but it seems like you're kind of ignoring some of the darker or more serious, meaningful kinds of interactions that can be more difficult to deal with, rather than just some kind of, like, you know, fun and light experience always. Given some of that, you know, some of these characters, and I guess some of the controversy surrounding psychedelics around that time, especially with, you know, it came in, like you mentioned, it had only been around for about 100 years, mostly. You know, there's talk of like what might have been happening a couple thousand years ago, but it came in, created a huge boom, and then almost immediately got shut down in terms of like historical time. And, you know, Timothy Leary, people have a lot of mixed feelings about him. What are your thoughts on him? Because he's such a crucial figure, and it seems like I feel like I'm missing quite a bit of information on him. Usually I hear the part of him that gets a bad rap, but it seems like it's difficult to make heads or tails of him and his impact and the way that he handled psychedelics. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, he's a very fascinating figure and a kind of larger than life character.
Mm-hmm.
What the response I got from a lot of my interviewees, because it was usually me asking that question, now I'm answering it, was that for good and for bad, quote unquote, Leary had to happen, was what a lot of people would say to me. He had to happen. You know, it had to go down the way it did. And yeah, you know, I think some people who were much more focused on the use of psychedelics for very sort of careful therapeutic use were very angry and disappointed by how they felt Leary had kind of overemphasized the benefits, underemphasized the risks, and I mean, for me personally, one thing I would say is he's a fantastic writer. He's a, yeah. he's a He's a fantastic writer. The book that I took that story from is called High Priest, and it's a collection of journey reports with different well-known people: William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, etc., Ram Dass, etc., etc., etc. It's a very strange and brilliant book, and very, very funny, very entertaining. He really knew how to write. I would say that for Leary, for starters. He's a very engaging author for me, and storyteller, and yeah, again, funny. Like, he sees the kind of dry or the wry humour or the irony in very strange, difficult situations, which I liked. I think, from what I gather, you know, he also, the circumstances of his life were pretty tragic. You know, his some of it's mentioned in the film, some not. He'd been this sort of careerist, ladder climbing academic, semi-alcoholic, perhaps, I've heard people say, and you know, his wife committed suicide, and you know, a big part of his journey, his story, is his seeing through the superficial relationship he had with his children, yeah, and vowing to kind of see their true inner nature from now on, and truly connect with them. And it doesn't seem to be the case that he was able to follow through on that after, you know, once the effects of that drug wore off. I'm not sure that LSD made him a more attuned, present, or responsible parent to his children. It perhaps indicate the opposite, actually, although I really don't want to sit in judgment on this man's life, you know.
Sure.
But what I would say is that I think one thread I see running through the journey of all three characters through their contact with psychedelics is three very intelligent, intellectual, perhaps ambitious men, all in their different ways, in all three of those journeys in the film, being invited to reflect on and see more clearly the ways in which they're not being fully authentic, they're not living fully authentically in relationship to themselves, in relationship to the people around them, and in relationship maybe to the world or to nature or to life itself. They're kind of all invited to kind of see through the hollow sham parts of the games they're playing or their ways of relating, and in that, invited to maybe do something differently. In each case, how fully able any of them or any of us are able to take that those messages and live them is, you know, is the next question.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something so interesting and important about, especially with this topic, something that's so hard to put into words, when you're able to have three figures like that are so articulate and are such good writers. You know, I knew about Huxley, I knew about Watts, and how well, you know, both of them in many ways had been kind of, a lot of their career had been putting words to things that other people couldn't explain, you know, especially with Watts and some of the Eastern ideas. And I wasn't familiar with how well or how good of a writer Leary was too. And, you know, I think for me, not, you know, not being too deep in this world, you know, I just heard, you know, mostly he just gets a bad rap. You know, I'd heard some stuff about him, you know, from Ram Dass and them, because I interviewed quite a people from that camp. But I think having figures like that are able to explain those things so well is such a better way of communicating these ideas. And there's a huge threat of, because, you know, we've all known probably the, you know, the people that have an experience and then it just blows their mind, and then, you know, you go and you try to explain it to people and it's like, oh, like that person just sounds crazy, and then it kind of makes like the whole thing sound like more wacky than it actually is. But they did such a good job of communicating that experience, and the animation helps it a lot as well. I mean, it's hard though, because it's something, it's so hard to get across. Is that one of the things that you were looking for in these stories? Like what is something that really, like, where are some of these sections of their writing where they really, like, kind of hit the nail on the head in describing these experiences? Because at the same time, though, it's also, like, it's also personal, and everybody's experience is a little bit different.
Mm. So what? I'll just clarify. What for? You're asking what for me was the parts where they best were able to communicate their experiences.
Like, is that something that you were looking for? Where you're like, okay, like that's the passage where, like, they really nailed it there. Because a lot of their writings are kind of explorative in a way. Because I've read Joyous Cosmology, and I listened to Doors of Perception on Audible, and it seems like, as good of writers as they are, like, some of the sections they're trying to find pieces, and other times it seems like they really, like, hit a section where it fits together nicely. Is that something that you were looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. And all I can do is, I think, in my process of, they're all fantastic books. Joyous Cosmology, amazing book. Doors of Perception, you know, what a book. Wow, what a writer. Yeah. What a mind Aldous Huxley was. And in my process of trying to whittle down those great books to kind of 12 to 15 minutes of talking, with enough pauses for the audience to grab a breath, because you can't just talk right. for 15 minutes straight, you know, is very important, pauses. And I probably could have left a few more spaces for pauses, you know, than I did.
I had quite a few rewinds.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait, what did he say? And then you also you also have the animation at the same time. I'm like trying to figure out what things mean. It was fun to navigate though.
Good. I'm glad. Yeah, I think if I did it again, that's probably the single clearest thing I would change, would just be to add in a few more pauses for the audience to reflect and digest. But coming back to your question, it's all I could do was use my subjective intuition, you know. So I just the bits that I'm reading where that grabs me and that grabs me and that grabs me, and then, you know, stitching those all together in a way that makes sense.
Why did they think that? And you can go like as little detail or as much as you want to. Why did they think that the way that things went down with Leary had to happen the way that they did? Like, what's their perspective on the long term impacts of that?
So you're asking me to kind of relay what other people have said to me. I think their perspective is there had to be this explosion into the mainstream. There had to be the backlash and the shutdown of any meaningful research for 50 odd years. And then now we've learned, the researchers and the scientists and the so forth have learned their lessons and are now doing it more carefully. I don't know if that's just them being sort of quite acceptant and zen about it, and saying, I think for one thing, you can't change it. It did happen.
Right.
No one's got the time machine. I would say that though, perhaps there is a tragedy there. I don't know that it can be laid solely at one man's feet. Or Timothy Leary's feet.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, those substances and inquiry, careful therapeutic inquiry, was prevented from happening for 50 or 60 years, I think, is also a real tragedy. Because, you know, before that, people like Stanislav Grof in the Czech Republic, people like Ronald Sanderson in the UK, and many, many more people around the world were doing quite successfully, doing work using psychedelics with their clients, with their patients, to as a therapeutic aid to kind of we could say magnify and release unconscious material. You know, there was even a film about Cary Grant, the actor's his journey through a long, like a lot, he had a long series of LSD therapy sessions that he claims gave him a whole new perspective on his childhood traumas, his behavioural patterns that were harming himself and harming people in his life close to him. So I'm not necessarily sure it had to happen. I'm pretty sure it did happen. and I will say, you know, in the film, was interested in exploring, touching on at least, let's say, some of the questions, the political, economic, social questions of why is our culture, why is this journey into the deep unconscious, the deep psyche, so dreaded by our culture? And that's not to say it shouldn't be taken very carefully and or done lightly, but why was that so shut down? And I thought that, you know, in the film, I thought that Graham Hancock brought that perspective quite effectively. Too. Yeah. Of, you know, who benefits the most from putting very strict limits on how individual adults can or can't explore the inner workings of their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that have to do with our economic system?
Yeah.
And our social system? And I think once you start getting into those areas, you risk upsetting a lot more people than just talking about psychedelics or psychology.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that might be the biggest benefit of the way that things went down, is that it really, you know, I'm a college student, I'm young, naive, I'm not, you know, perfectly historically literate on that time by any stretch. It seems like it blew some holes in the way that these kinds of things are treated, the government response, issues within issues within academia. It seems like it was so disruptive that a lot of, and the response to it kind of showed that there were some control issues that maybe needed to be changed. You know, a lot of people are sort of questioning motives much more about the government and why they have different kind of rules in place. And, you know, you mentioned that the importance of these things being treated carefully, but it doesn't seem like they treated them carefully either. Like, it seems like they kind of just freaked out. Like, it wasn't like these people are too gung-ho about them and like they're going overboard, so like we need to rein them in. It's like they did the same thing on the other side. It didn't seem like they carefully considered things either. They kind of just shut it down. And, you know, the Nixon saying with Leary being the most dangerous man in America, it seems like it really kind of exposed some of the issues with control and not wanting people to think differently.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you can even go a step further than saying, oh, they weren't careful in their shutting down of it. What's kind of in the public record now is actually the kind of quite brutal, horrific experiments that the security services and the military were conducting using psychedelics actually for the opposite of healing, to control, to manipulate and break people. And they were doing this to their own soldiers, to American citizens. So care for human well-being doesn't always, you know, as their motive, doesn't always quite add up when you look at the research the military and security services were doing with these substances, sometimes involving, you know, my understanding, scientists brought over from Nazi Germany. You know, it's a pretty harrowing tale. There are some pretty harrowing tales about how the government were using these substances compared to how the people they were banning were using them.
Yeah.
That was the first part of my response. And the second one, you'd have to remind me of the question.
I also don't know what I said.
It was about control.
I mean, it seems like it called into question, you know, what their real goal was with the kinds of policies on these things. And, you know, Graham Hancock, like you said, he was really pointing to that. Rick Doblin in the documentary and many other places as well, he's been very critical of, because he was also against Vietnam and things like that. And it seems like much more about it was trying to get people to fall in line, and these substances have an ability to have such an explosive and life-changing experience that completely shifts your perspective, which you know, we saw with all three of those stories. Like, all of them were like, okay, like, what is actually going on here? Like, why are we playing these different kinds of games? And it turns out that threatens the stability of a country and a government quite a bit. But you know, it just seems like it had very little to do with the actual potential benefits or the real use cases of the medicines themselves. And or you know, medicines of, you know, you want to be careful with the term, but I'll call them substances. I don't want to go too far into like the wordplay and stuff of like what you want to call them, but it seems like, and you know, with them making them Schedule 1 even too, and saying that they're, you know, high risk for addiction and things like that, which, you know, doesn't really seem to be very accurate. Because you know, who's getting addicted to, you know, a lot of people will have an experience to be like, okay, I'm good. You know, it doesn't seem like very many people are getting addicted to psychedelics. But
no, I'm not sure I'm aware of any documented cases.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I would add that these are substances that one of the few things they seem to be able to produce reliably, regularly, is their potential, no guarantee, to produce a profound mystical experience, a religious or mystical experience. And you know, some people have drawn interesting parallels between this age-old question of direct religious experience versus second or third hand religious experience on a Sunday morning at church. And you know, there's maybe some parallels to be drawn between a time when only the priest only even read the Mass in Latin, which the average person couldn't even understand. There's perhaps something about who benefits from the sort of majority of the populace having access to mystical, direct mystical experiences, that we know from, I think, you know, Roland Griffiths' study, people generally rank as one of the most meaningful experiences of their lives. And I would draw a link somewhere between that, because as well as a filmmaker, I'm also a body psychotherapist, and so I would draw a link there between what Carl Jung once said, which is he basically said that not one of his, back then they said patients, not clients, he said not one of his patients got better, quote unquote, who didn't find a way to reconnect with their religious or spiritual life.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, Carl Jung, one of the most sort of heavyweight psychologists of the 20th century, drawing a very important connection between our inner spiritual life and our mental well-being.
Yeah, he wrote about that quite a bit in Modern Man in Search for a Soul. Like the issue with like kind of tearing down religious systems and things like that, and leaving kind of a void in matters of the soul, whereas like psychology wasn't meant to deal with that, and it was trying to kind of replace that, but it wasn't doing it very well. And he's talking about like the relationship between psychotherapists and clergymen, and like how they were serving different needs. But if people don't have this thing where they can get more in touch with the soul, then there's really kind of a void that can't be replaced with more, with, you know, a lot of the typical practices that you'll see in psychotherapy. Yeah, he had a lot of interesting perspectives on that kind of stuff. But it seems like you're drawing a connection between, or I guess across groups of power, whether it be religious institutions or governments, where it seems like they're seeing some kind of benefit of being mediators for a certain kind of experience, and prefer that the normal people don't have direct access themselves. Because does it seem like it's some kind of threatening to the structure of everything that they're worried about?
I can't speak to, as unlike perhaps a lot of pundits, I can't sort of give you a nice clean, well, they do that because you know it does that. I don't know how even sort of individually conscious these questions are. They seem to maybe be more systemic. I mean, maybe there is a group of people somewhere, you know, saying mystical experiences threaten our economic power, let's shut them down. I mean, maybe it's that crude, but
seems
maybe
like it's just a tendency.
Maybe it's just a systemic tendency. I don't know either way, but I try to be careful when talking about they and them.
Right. Because who's that?
Because who are they?
Right,
you know,
yeah.
And you know, compared to the world's population, you and I are probably we're in somewhere in the pretty high percentile, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, we're them.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I absolutely would be drawing a connection between power, vested interests, and some wish to control or mediate people's access to their own deep inner worlds, and through that to kind of what we might call transcendent, transpersonal, or mystical experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these as I'm trying to like think through these on the fly, I'm kind of exploring different ideas. But you know, I think, you know, these kinds of things might have been the benefit. You know, but back to the question that I had asked about, like, why do things have to go down the way that they did? You know, it seems like these were a catalyst for these kinds of, like, that whole situation was a catalyst for these kinds of questions. And you know, why? What are some of the motives and some of the ways that the government or groups of power are regulating these substances? So that's, you know, while there was a lot of research that was lost, you know, things, it got halted. Luckily, you know, you mentioned Roland Griffiths. He did a really good job of somehow getting that approved in the first place. And then this whole resurgence of these studies has been pretty cool. But it seems, you know, so there was a great loss there. But it seems like the benefit is, you know, making people think a little bit more about, at least it seems like that's been an impact on me. And you know, people that I've talked to is, you know, questioning, I guess, some of the motives behind some of these decisions, and I guess just looking at things from a different perspective.
Mm. Yeah.
For the interviewees, how did you go about picking them, and then how did you go about structuring like what kinds of questions to ask them?
Hmm. How did I pick them? There's a 2-yearly biannual conference in the UK called Breaking Convention, and they were very helpful and supportive, the people who run that, and I would attend that during my process of making the film, and that was a great recruiting ground to go to lots of different talks and just see which ones really resonated with me, which speakers resonated, and then, you know, great way to approach them and have start a conversation with them. And some of it was down to opportunity. So I was based in the UK. I was based in London, and I wasn't able to fly around the world and interview whoever I wanted. So you know, Dennis McKenna was passing through. I reached out to him. Rick Doblin the same. Gabor Mate. You know, that was just sort of good fortune that we were able to cross paths and make our schedules align, and they were very kind, you know, kind enough to give me some of their time to speak in the film. How did I structure my questions? Well, the interview process was an interesting one because kind of the film was ended up being a dialogue between these current thinkers and these authors, Leary, Huxley and Watts from the 50s, 60s. And it was beautiful to be able to facilitate that because it wouldn't have felt right to just offer a perspective from 60 years ago, 70 years ago, you know, to the audience. I felt a responsibility or a need to balance that or contextualize that with, okay, where are we now? That was then. What have we learned since? And we've learned a lot, you know, which is what we humans are good at. We're good at moving on in our thinking and our doing, hopefully, sometimes, not always. It was quite a protracted process. I would show each interviewee one of the animations. We'd sit and watch it together for 15 minutes, and then I'd use that animation as a jumping-off point. And I mean, yeah. So my interviewing style, I like to be open to what's emerging and just to follow the thread of the conversation. But I had my written notes and I would scan over them at the end and make sure we'd ticked off roughly everything I wanted to cover, you know, and so it was an involved process from the interviewees. They, you know, it took a good 3 hours or more to watch three animations, talk about each one, you know, with breaks. But it was a cheat way would have been for me to just talk about the issues we talked about. I could have done that without showing them the films, but that wasn't, you know, I had to have them reacting to the stories because, I don't know, it was important. It was really important to have that dialogue, to not sort of have two separate worlds I'm jamming together in the edit, but to have them, you know, and I even, you know, there were people they'd heard something about that. Oh, you know, I heard that happened that way from someone who was there, or there's all sorts of strange, wonderful facts and knowledge emerged during that process. But something I began earlier and didn't quite complete was telling you, you know, about the structure of the film. We had Leary, Huxley, Watts. And for me, that journey was sort of Leary's overwhelm and quite what we might call nihilistic. You know, he's left with this view that life is just a series of waves and particles bouncing around with not a great deal of other meaning. That was, you know, Leary's sort of disillusionment with life. And then it was important then to go into Huxley's fascination with and embracing of the natural world and the flower, contrasting that with the falsity of modern machines, cars, Hollywood Boulevard, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally to end with Watts saying, well, we're all just the eternal energy of the universe playing hide and seek with itself. You know, it was important to take the audience on that journey from kind of disillusionment through re-enchantment with nature, and somehow maybe an acceptance of one of our biggest challenges as a species, which is our self-conscious knowledge of our immortality, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our knowledge that we're going to die one day, and how on earth do we make some sort of peace with that?
Yeah,
which I think psychedelics offer something. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, how the thoughts around them change and the research develops over time. It, you know, it seems like it has a good head of steam right now, so hopefully things, you know, continue on course. But in terms of the way that you did the interviews, I'm glad that you did it that way and having them watch and like it was have a conversation. It was cool to kind of see, you know, some of the thought leaders in this space now responding to some of the thought leaders in the space then, and then you're like, you know, there was this 50-year halt, but it was kind of like a depiction of bridging the gap between these two time periods when the conversation was really brewing. So I thought that was cool. So moving forward, what kind of things have you been working on recently? Is this something that you're still interested in working on or exploring, or have you been focusing on other kinds of projects? What have you been up to lately?
I've got a couple of projects in the pipeline. One is more about the shamanic
Cool.
approach and understanding of these tools, these substances, these what they might call plant medicines. That's one project I'm currently focusing on, and the other is about body psychotherapy, about what some people might call somatic psychology, this thing of bringing mind and body closer together, because as modern Western societies, we are incredibly alienated from our physicality, from our physical bodies, and increasingly so with all this technology. We're very rapidly inventing and evolving, and has its great uses, but also I think looking at new and younger generations growing up more and more, so many of us are living sort of virtual lives, virtual kind of disembodied lives, and so I'm wanting to make this film looking back at the development of body psychotherapy, which goes back to roughly the time of Freud. It goes back at least 100 years, and it's been kind of a bit, don't know what to say really. It's a bit kind of the body. So, for instance, Wilhelm Reich was one of the pioneers of what we now call body psychotherapy, and he was a pupil of Freud's, and he dared to try to bring the body back into the consulting room rather than just seeing ourselves as kind of verbalizing disembodied minds. And there was a huge reaction to that, and it's kind of the body's been kind of somehow made shadow, we could say. As I said, I myself am a body psychotherapist and a filmmaker, so I'm very interested in bringing some of these ideas to a wider public, just like I tried to do with Journeys.
Well, yeah, I was curious in if you had been interested in other ways of exploring consciousness and awareness. So it's cool that you have those brewing. So I'll be on the lookout. Do you have I know just from experience of like asking various people this that timelines. It's kind of like who knows, especially depending on how long you've been working on either one. But do you have any idea of when either of them might be wrapping up or coming out?
I can't give you any sort of date or timeline yet. All I can
Okay.
say is watch this space and
Cool.
give me a couple of years.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. Cool. Well, where's the best place for people to get in touch with the film? Is it the website?
Yeah, it
Okay.
would be the website of the film, which is
Okay. I'll link that.
www.journeysmovie.com, and yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
And it's great. We had a screening of the film in Colorado last week. We had a screening in Portland, Oregon, in the fall. So it's the film still has a life. It's still
Yeah.
being kind of picked up and shown by, particularly by like local groups, local psychedelic societies, people like that. So I would encourage anyone who's listening who feels called to check out the film and enjoys it. I'm still encouraging people to consider organizing local screenings of the film.
Cool. Yeah, it's both fun if you're interested in these kinds of things and thought-provoking at the same time. So yeah, I would highly recommend anybody interested in the space to check it out. But thanks a lot for coming on and talking with me again. I really enjoyed the film, like I said before, and I've had a good time talking with you today, man. So thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Jake. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah.